May it please the court and counsel, I would like to reserve 1 minute for rebuttal.
That's fine.
I'm Phil Nino and I represent Fabian Voxman in this matter. This is a situation where Mr. Voxman was convicted at a jury trial under 18 U.S.C. 875C, and this was because he had emailed a threat from Spokane to a municipal court commissioner here in the city of Seattle. A little bit of background, he had been hired by the Air Force in 2005 and brought up from Houston to work as a group historian for the Air Force in Spokane, and he was fired soon after. A Seattle law firm declined to represent him after his own EEOC complaint failed after he was terminated from the Air Force. And because of his dialogue with that Seattle advocacy law firm, he was...
We're pretty familiar with the record. Why don't you focus and tell us why, was it the March 20th email?
I can't remember. Certainly, Your Honor, and I've got the...
I can't remember exactly.
In the brief, at the bottom of the page.
Why doesn't that constitute a true threat?
Well, because, first of all, the case law tells us that we look at the entire context of this language, and when you do that, it appears that the language is all that the government had here. If you look at the context, this gentleman stayed in Spokane. He never even came over to Seattle. In fact, that's what got him in trouble, because he did not appear in municipal court, and so he was issued a notice of a warrant.
The language looks pretty scary, doesn't it?
I'm sorry.
The language looks pretty scary, doesn't it?
Well,
so then the question is, you know, if objectively, let's assume that's a separate element, if objectively somebody might be a little bit nervous getting that language, then the question is, did he intend, right? I guess that's the way we put it. Did he intend to convey that threat? Did he intend it?
Exactly. Correct? And if you look at the
comment, and a jury looked at everything and said, yep, we think so. We don't believe his story about, oh, I just like to use strong language.
The story was corroborated throughout the emails that came into exhibits and throughout the testimony that his feeling that he had a duty to express himself in polemic rhetoric, maybe somewhat repugnant and acerbic ways. However, that's all you have if you look at the rest of the context. Unlike Bagdasarian, this gentleman had no history of involvement with guns. He remained in Spokane. There's no evidence he came over here. Of course, that got him in trouble because that got him the warrant.
But in Bagdasarian, wasn't the key issue that what was alleged to be a threat there was really a prediction that other people would harm the presidential candidate, or that the appellant in that case was actually encouraging other people to harm, whereas in this March 20th email, it's pretty explicit. If I were to murder him, it's much more explicit that Mr. Voxman was intending to carry out the threat himself versus trying to incite others.
First of all, if, yes, Your Honor, he said, if I were to, but the big point the court raises, Your Honor raises, is that in Bagdasarian and in Planned Parenthood, these people who were making these statements published them to the public. Here we have Mr. Voxman, and his audience is who? Deputy United States Marshals, an assistant U.S. attorney.
Is that better or worse?
I would say it's better because it's...
If you send something to the newspaper that says, somebody should take that Fernandez out of action, that's better than if you write to me and say, than if you write to me personally and say, you know, I shouldn't have to be compelled to take the law into my own hands, but if you were shot down, how did he put it? You should be murdered, and self-defense would be an awfully good defense for me. So if he sends me that letter, that's less of a threat than if he says somebody ought to take me out?
Technically, he did not send it directly to the commissioner.
Okay, fine, I understand.
But we know that he probably knew it was going to get to him.
Yeah, so my question is then, it's less of a threat if he sends it to me than if he publishes it in the newspaper?
I would think so, because look at who's looking at this situation. You've got government law enforcement officials. There's some United States Air Force officers. These are all career government upstanding folks that he's communicated to. But if I communicate it through the newspaper to the whole world, who are you going to attract and who are you going to incite to take this action that you're talking about? And I think that very point shows that this was mere speech. And if you look at it with the other context, for example, the conditional language, there's no planning whatsoever. His computer was seized upon search of his apartment, and nothing indicated any sort of a plan or any sort of anything backing this up.
Doesn't the fact that Mr. Vaxman sent it to the government officials that you and the lawyer for Judge Eisenberg support actually that there was subjective intent that this be a threat? If he sent it to the people who basically previously told him that your language is of concern to people, you need not to do that, and the fact that he went ahead and did it anyway, why doesn't that support that he really had the subjective intent for this to be a threat, a true threat?
Well, first of all, when he was interviewed by the marshals on two different occasions, he explained to them that this was his intent and he had no malintent toward whomever his targets were during those prior emails. If you recall, and I know I'm going to switch to objective intent to answer your question, Your Honor, Commissioner Eisenberg testified that it said murdered in it. I don't care if it was conditional or not. It said murdered. Commissioner Eisenberg, and this goes to Mr. Boxman's specific intent, I believe, he wasn't told of the entire background of how this guy is a prolific writer and he has been emailing to all these officials regarding his concerns about this case or that case and so forth. I think it all points to a lack of specific intent to do any harm. And even Commissioner Eisenberg said, the fact that it had murdered in it, that's all I cared about. And remember, he was only given two proximal emails. One of them was the subject of the indictment. He wasn't given any history of this guy and his loquaciousness, his ongoing dialogue. Again, not very pleasant. Just like the ruling in Bagdasarian, Mr. Voxman may be looked upon as not a very pleasant fellow. So I would I assert that all goes to lack of specific intent, mere language. He never followed up on anything before his prior communications with other people.
All right. Do you want to save a minute and 16 seconds for rebuttal?
I do.
All right.
Do you have any questions at this point? Any more questions?
If we do, we'll use up your minute.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Tyler Tornabene. I represent the United States of America. And this case, as your honors are aware, the evidence at trial was sufficient for a jury to find beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant did in fact communicate.
What's the jury's role in this kind of case?
Your Honor, that's a very interesting question given the standard of review issues. And I think that's a very important point to address at the outset, which is the defendant argues in his briefing that this is a de novo review and then kind of in the alternative says, well, maybe it's not. It's very clear to state that this is not a de novo review for this court. In this court in Hanna after Planned Parenthood, I think, really clarified. This is a two-step process for this court. The first step is the more familiar and deferential standard of viewing the facts in the light most favorable to the government. Could any rational trier of fact have found the essential elements of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt? Once this court makes that determination, which here this court should, then because there are obvious First Amendment implications to a true threat case, Planned Parenthood and Hanna would have you move on to the second step, which is that independent review of the facts to see if the core constitutional fact of a true threat has been met. What's key here...
Now, is that an objective inquiry on our part?
Your Honor, I don't know if objective is how would be the best way to describe it. And that's a little confusing here because true threat has objective and subjective yes. components. However, what it is this court would be bound by the facts, non-core constitutional facts, as found by the jury. That includes historical facts, that includes undisputed facts, and very significantly here, it includes credibility determinations by the jury. And that's very important, for instance, when looking at the core constitutional fact of subjective intent. The defendant testified that he used things sort of metaphorically, that murder was a metaphor for prosecution. The jury nonetheless found him guilty, was properly instructed on the subjective intent, clearly rejected that. That's a credibility determination that the jury made that this court is bound by in its independent review. So to put it another way, the jury in its determination has sort of defined the universe of the non-core constitutional facts for your honors. Your honors independent review should then look at those facts and see if in your independent judgment they add up to the core constitutional issue of a objective, serious expression of intent to injure or kill, subjectively so intended. And when your honors look at this record, especially as defined by the jury, as it must be, for instance, the credibility determination against Mr. Voxman on those key points, the evidence clearly shows that, in fact, this was a serious expression of intent to kill or injure and was so intended by the defendant. What's very important in this, and I think there's some confusion in the defendant's brief and in the defendant's argument, it's important to define and I guess reiterate from the clear case law what is and is not part of that analysis. It is not a requirement of a true threat, either statutorily under 875 subparagraph C or constitutionally, that there be any imminency or immediacy to the threat. It's simply not required. It is not required that...
But what if we look at, in Bagdasarian, the appellant actually had the, you know, 50 caliber, he had actually the weapons in his possession that would have enabled him to carry out what was in his blog entries. And in this instance, what if we just say, look, objectively, okay, Mr. Waxman may be using, unfortunately, flowery language, but he had no ability to carry out and actually execute on any of these threats because he's in Spokane, he doesn't have weapons.
Your Honor, the fact of, and I think the record is very clear, and you're correct, the defendant did not have weapons. There's no evidence that he had an ability or an intention to carry out these threats. However, that is not required for the conviction. It is, and I think this is maybe what Your Honor's question sort of goes to, if those facts are present, that is clearly relevant in a determination of the defendant's subjective intent. It's not required, but those would certainly be relevant facts. Now, they were relevant in Bagdasarian. However,
don't we have to sort of find that objectively a reasonable person would understand and sort of interpret this communication to be a true threat?
Yes.
Is that a requirement in addition to whether Mr. Waxman had the subjective intent for this to be a true threat?
Yes, Your Honor, it is. However, in that analysis, that would be where the speaker's ability to carry it out is not, I suppose it could be a relevant factor, however, that is not a very relevant factor. And the reason is that the reason true threats are not protected under the First Amendment is not because somebody may or may not carry it out. That's certainly part of it. But I would say the gravamen of it is that that kind of speech instills fear, regardless of the ability or intention of the person to carry it out. Strong enough words in the context, such as the March 20th email, where you have the defendant making statements very clearly, I would be the actor, I, Voxman, would be the actor, potentially murdering Commissioner Eisenberg. That sort of language is not protected because it instills fear when we look at it from an objectively reasonable listener. The victim's viewpoint is certainly a relevant factor in that analysis, but so is the reaction of other listeners, such as the Marshals Service here, that communicated that to the court security for Commissioner Eisenberg because they took it as a serious expression, especially in the context of what they were dealing with. Mr. Voxman had been warned on previous occasions that his comments were instilling fear in people, specifically AUSA Viviano, and that was in weeks before the March 20th email. And yet, in an email, and I forget the precise date, but it's after that March meeting with the Marshals, prior to the March 20th email, Mr. Voxman sends an email in part to Deputy Marshal Kevin Kilgore stating that, essentially, I understand that I'm creating fear in people. And if they would just do what I want them to do, I wouldn't have to do that. Now, that's a clear indication that he is attempting to leverage the fear he creates to accomplish various goals. And that is the essence of a threat. And that's why under the objective analysis as well as the subjective analysis.
Did the jury do, how was the jury instructed on the objective-subjective issues?
Your Honor, they were instructed on both of those elements, that they needed to find both an objectively true threat, so defined under the case law, primarily in Black, as well as that the defendant subjectively intended his communication as a threat.
So we're just taking it, I guess, in your, I'm still trying to understand exactly what, you know, how much scrutiny we're supposed to give to the First Amendment implications.
Your Honor, it's an interesting standard of review. What I believe is called for this court is, and I think the touchstone, is to look at the reasons for that second step in the process. And the reason is to make sure that a jury verdict does not impinge on constitutionally protected speech, even giving that deference to the jury. And the way that the case law, as explained in Hanna and Planned Parenthood, really guides this court is that the deference to the non-core facts that the jury finds, that needs to be preserved. But then, in this court's independent review, in looking at those facts, does that add up to an objective true threat and a subjective intent?
Okay. All right.
In this case, a review of the record does show that, in fact, it does. And I think it is. It bears really, I believe, I don't want to repeat the record, because I know Your Honors are very familiar with it. But the March 20th email, there's an attempt by the defendant to analogize this to Bagdasarian. Bagdasarian was very different factually. And in the brief time I have left, the key issues in Bagdasarian that make it different than this case are, first, it was in a public forum, an online message board, and a nonviolent one. It was like a Yahoo Finance message board. And secondly, and this was mentioned by the court in Bagdasarian multiple times, the statements in Bagdasarian, while very offensive, did not contain the idea of I will shoot President Obama. Here we have clear indication from Mr. Voxman that he would be the actor murdering Commissioner Eisenberg. And for that reason, I ask that you affirm the conviction.
Thank you, counsel.
Just in rebuttal and briefly, Your Honors, Bagdasarian, in addition to possessing a 50 caliber rifle that he talked about shooting then candidate Obama, and he actually had one in his apartment there that was apparently motivated by something along the lines of racial hatred. He talked about plink, plink, plink. Now, the court brought up, and I did not bring up, the jury deliberation issue. As the court can see from the brief, they deliberated for an hour and 40 minutes, and that included lunch, and that included...
But which way does that cut? Does that mean that the evidence was overwhelming, so the jury didn't need a lot of time, or how do we conclude?
I can't see. I think the bottom line is it should have been a legal decision rather than a decision made by a jury, a factual decision made by a jury, because I don't think they fully understood the scrutiny required to analyze the situation. And I
there was no challenge to the jury instructions, correct?
There was not, and the jury instructions did require specific intent and objective intent. That's correct. But how could they have, in the 20 minutes left, how could they have read in ER 109 to 125, we've got the various emails, and most of them are full, a single space, full page.
Well, the trial lasted, what, a day and a half?
Yes, about that. Is that right, Tyler?
All right. You're over your time now.
Okay.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you.